versus United States. Okay, Ms. Greenaway.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Amber Greenaway, and I represent the appellant, Donna Parks, in this case. We're here today on one discrete issue. And that's whether trial counsel rendered ineffective assistance of counsel to Ms. Parks by allowing her to plead guilty under willful blindness theory. We contend that he did. This court previously made clear in United States versus Rivera that willful blindness should only be used in comparatively rare cases where it can almost be said that a defendant actually knew of the existence of a fact.
Can I want to back up to a more fundamental question before you get into that.
Yes, sir.
And that is, it's inherent in the COA, which you just read identically,
yes.
And in the nature of the claim as massaged by the magistrate judge. And that is the concept of allowing someone to plead guilty. How can counsel ever allow someone to plead guilty or disallow someone to plead guilty? As I understand it, there are about four or five fundamental decisions that a client can make on his or herself. And one of those is the decision to plead guilty. So that if counsel is literally yelling, "Don't do this, this is horrible, stop, I am advising you not to do this," there is no right for someone to disallow the decision to plead. And so I guess inherent in the question is, what are we here for if the record supports and we decide that your client wished to plead guilty, even understanding that there was a factual deficiency?
Sure, Your Honor. So I think what the magistrate judge and also what the Judge Jordan in the COA and granting the COA was trying to get at is that when accepting guilty pleas, both the government and the defense counsel have to assent that there is an adequate factual basis to accept the plea. And here there was no adequate factual basis.
Well, Rule 11, as I understand it, simply requires the district court to find a factual basis for a plea. But I've taken a bunch of pleas in my life. I've offered pleas in my life. There is something called an Alford plea.
Yes.
Which simply says, I as counsel and I as client don't agree that I did any of this. But the government has evidence that could prove that I did the crime.
And they've offered me something that makes it worthwhile for me not to call their bluff.
That's correct. But in North Carolina versus Alford, the Supreme Court case, and this is a direct quote from the court, because of the importance of protecting the innocent and ensuring that guilty pleas are a product of free and intelligent choice, various state and federal court decisions properly caution that pleas coupled with claims of innocence should not be accepted.
I agree with you. But here's the problem.
Sure.
There's not the claim below was not my plea was accepted by the court without a factual basis, and the COA is not that I am not guilty because there was no factual basis for my guilty plea. The claim is my counsel was ineffective. And I just don't get how counsel could be ineffective for allowing a client to do what the client insists on doing.
Well, counsel was ineffective here, Judge Luck, because he proffered a willful blindness theory when the facts didn't support it. In United States versus Rivera, we took great pains to set up procedural safeguards on when willful blindness can even be relied on.
But if your client tells you, you're representing your client below, if your client tells you, listen, I didn't think I did this, but I think I'm going to be convicted, and more importantly, I'm facing life in prison, and I don't want to do that. They're offering me something that's a lot less, and I want to take that. Do what you can to take that. How is counsel allowing or disallowing that? I don't understand how a counsel could be ineffective for doing what the client wishes to do.
Because you can't evade constitutional safeguards to do that, Your Honor. And that's what's underpinning this.
I know, but if the question is, if the claim was about the constitutional safeguard, I think I would understand that. But the claim wasn't about that, and I understand why, because it would be waived. And so to get around that, your client, I know you didn't do this, your client, pro se, sought an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. And so we're just hearing whether counsel was effective. How can counsel be ineffective for doing what the client wishes to do? And more importantly, how can counsel be ineffective for stopping someone from making their constitutional decision to plead guilty?
Well, I think counsel here is ineffective, Your Honor, for three reasons. First, ignoring her protestations of innocence. At that point, he should have withdrew the guilty plea and reconvened.
This goes to my point. How can counsel withdraw a guilty plea when a client does not want the counsel to do that? In other words, the counsel does not have the right to withdraw a guilty plea without the consent of the client. We'd be hearing the opposite if that happened.
Right. Whereas I think maybe a hypothetical might assist the court. So if Ms. Parks came to her trial counsel and said, you know, let's get this plea done. I don't want to risk jail time. Let's get it done. And she says, I'm going to get up there and lie. Counsel can't allow that, right? So that's kind of the same thing. Here we just have a unique factual scenario.
I don't think there's any allegation that she lied here.
No, she testified completely true. But I'm just, you know, offering a for the court.
That's, but in that sense, what counsel would say is, listen, Your Honor, I have to silently withdraw here. You understand, wink, wink, you understand why, and my client's going to do what she's going to do. But the counsel cannot say, I am withdrawing a plea on your behalf. The counsel can't do that, can they?
No.
No, Your Honor. But counsel can, when the plea colloquy transcript, the district court did ask trial counsel whether he assented to the factual basis. I want to ensure that there was a factual basis, and he said no. And separately, this is, we talk about this in our briefs. But trial counsel also, it is Ms. Park's contention that during the recess that occurred here, trial counsel erroneously advised her about willful blindness theory and what was caused. Now, of course, as the government mentioned in their brief, and we readily concede, there is no evidence in the record about what occurred and what conversation occurred, which goes to why we may need an evidentiary.
But if the claim, but I guess this goes to the claim. If the claim was my counsel misadvised me about the elements of willful blindness, then that I could understand that, and we could have a discussion about that. I think there might be some problems, but we can get over that. But the claim was not that, at least as read by the magistrate judge. The claim was the counsel provided ineffective assistance by allowing the client to plead guilty to the charge under a deliberate ignorance theory. Not the misadvising of the deliberate ignorance theory, but that allowing the client to plead. And I guess that just gets questions to me about who has the right to decide to plead. Because in the plea colloquy, it seems that every indication was that your client wanted to plead guilty at that time. Now, I understand why. I get it. But how could client disallow that? How could counsel disallow that? How could counsel get in the way of that?
Counsel can simply just say, Your Honor, you know, at the district court level, there's simply just no evidence to support the plea. And also, counsel should not have proffered the willful blindness theory. United States versus Rivera makes clear that before the theory can even be proffered, there has to be evidence that points to that fact. And here there is
evidence. You keep saying that, but in the plea colloquy itself, your client said when colloquied by the judge, she said Alford, her co-defendant, not the case, had put some luggage in the car, and I didn't know what was in the luggage, nor did I look what was in the luggage. Court said, did you have any reason to believe there was a gun in that luggage?
He's known to tote one.
And so, she says, so I'm not, the court, you didn't ask, but part of you knew there was that he probably had a gun in that car. Yes, ma'am. In that luggage. Yes, ma'am. And then later, that day when you got in the car and he put that bag in the car, did part of you believe that he probably had a gun or drugs in the bag? Yes, ma'am. And did you purposely not ask about it so that you would not be liable for it? Yes, ma'am. And what, I mean, she's talking best interest offered plea. She knows what she wants. This colloquy, Parks, I didn't know about this gun. This is earlier, before she admitted that she had reason. So I didn't agree. It's stating that I know you, I willingly took part in possession, and I didn't, because I didn't know that was there. But I'm going to plead guilty because that's better than interrupted by the court. Pity. Well, I can't let you plead guilty if the facts aren't there. And then she goes on to admit, under questioning by the judge, that she thought there was probably a gun there.
So, two parts to your question, Ms. Carnes. So, that first transcript part that you read, even the government said, Your Honor, we have concerns that that's not enough to suffice.
Government's wrong. Government is wrong. If she thought there was a gun in that luggage and she deliberately took action or inaction to avoid learning the truth, that is, we call it deliberate ignorance, they call it willful blindness, it's the same thing. That supplies intent under our decisions.
No, Your Honor, and I'm going to push back slightly on that, because the case law is clear. It is a higher standard. So it's not, she answered, he's known to tote one, but then another part of the transcript, she said, at times, never in my possession, never around me. And so she also says that. So the case law is clear that it's not just mere negligence or gross negligence or recklessness. It has to be all but certain that she knew.
But part of you knew that there was, that he probably had a gun in that car. Yes, ma'am.
That's a negligent standard, Your Honor.
No. It's by definition, deliberate ignorance or willful blindness, you don't know for sure. If you did, we wouldn't be talking about blindness and ignorance. It's, you suspect it's in there, but you take deliberate actions not to find out. Are you deliberate inactions? And that's, this is classic textbook deliberate ignorance, willful blindness that she admitted in that colloquy. That's a question.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. So I would encourage the court to, and I have a handy case list here, just a list of some cases that show what counts here. It has to be strong evidence, not what she should have known, not that she maybe have suspected. There's strong evidence. The quintessential case is whether you're handed one case, a defendant was handed an empty suitcase laden with cocaine and was paid $10,000 to deliver the suitcase to another city. These are the types of evidence that matters. And I have citations, but I'm happy to provide those on rebuttal if that answers Your Honor's questions.
Well, are they not cited in your brief?
Oh, they are.
Okay. But then I think we know about it.
Okay.
Judge Luck, I think, has a question.
I just have one question, and this is a little bit different than what we've been talking about. I think you mentioned this in your brief, but I just want to underscore this.
Yes.
You've been clear with your client that if you prevail here, that there is a significant risk if she goes to trial and she is convicted that her sentence will be a lot higher than it was in the pre-sentence plea, because it was capped based on the way the plea was done here, and that she'd have to go back into prison. Your client understands this.
Yes, sir. I've explained this to the client, that there is some risk of conviction on all the charges if we are successful here today to vacate the plea. But the client,
and that comes with the risk of having to go back to prison.
Yes, Your Honor. I've explained the circumstances to her, and she's well aware of the risk, but she wants to vindicate her rights because she believes that she was erroneously advised.
Okay. Let's hear from Ms. McEwen.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Leah McEwen for the United States. I'd like to march through the record in this case with the court bearing in mind that Ms. Parks bears the burden.
Yep.
She bears the burden because, in a case of a guilty plea, finality is presumed unless she's able to shoulder that strict burden under Strickland. So what we have here is Ms. Parks appeared before the district court to tender her plea in a Rule 11 colloquy. There was some discussion about the adequacy of the factual basis, and she said, I want to plead guilty. That is before the recess in which the unsupported claim of coercion or misapplication of the understanding of deliberate ignorance.
Let's talk about coercion for a second. So one of the arguments that your opposing counsel makes on behalf of her client is that there was, during the meeting, there was pressure, I think pressure is the word that's used, applied to the client here in order to get the client to plead guilty. We don't know what happened there. There's a silent record on that, but we have the allegations, and as I understand it in this posture, we have to take those allegations as true until there's at least conclusive evidence otherwise. So, A, if we take it as true, where does that lead us? And B, is there conclusive evidence to refute the allegation that there's pressure?
So I don't doubt that there was pressure in the colloquial sense, as I'm sure that your honors are familiar. This conversation with counsel about how to resolve a criminal case is an inherently unpleasant conversation.
Unpleasant isn't the allegation.
None of the options seem good. Option A, proceed to trial and face 15 to life. Option B, take this plea, stat cap of 120, hope for something less. Or maybe small chance of acquittal at trial. Let me tell you, if you're counsel, what I think would happen at trial. Based on those standards that opposing counsel laid out in her brief about counsel should study the law and the facts in this case. So I don't know that there's enough with her allegation in those later pleadings of pressure to establish legal coercion.
Well, let's be clear. A plea cannot be accepted other than voluntarily.
Yes.
We agree with that. If counsel pressured someone to accept a plea, then by definition, it's not voluntary. So I think that's the implication here. That's the consequence. So my question to you is, assuming the truth of the allegation, is that sufficient to state a claim? And then second is, if it is, is there conclusive evidence in the record to rebut the allegation of pressure applied to the client?
So I'll start with the last question.
Sure.
I do think there's adequate evidence in the record.
Tell me what that evidence is.
That is when she was under oath before the court in the plea colloquy and said no one is threatened.
So the counter to that, though, and this is not me, this is your opposing counsel speaking, is that statement was made before the hour-long recess. And then after the hour-long recess, there is no indication. That question isn't re-asked by the district judge here.
I agree with the court that that is the sequence of events here. But I also think that what we can take from the colloquy is that Judge Gardner was very attentive to the defendant's body language, her facial expressions, things like this that a fact finder is required to be attentive to. And what I'd point the court to specifically on that is, I believe it's on page 10 of the change of plea transcript, when I have read the factual basis as agreed to in writing from the plea, and initially there's a sort of a yes answer that's given, and then Judge Gardner says, I see you looking, and that's when Ms. Park says something to the effect of, I didn't actively possess.
You're certainly right, and there's, in my mind, no blame to be had with regard to the district court here, but the district court wasn't privy to what happened in the hour-long conversation in the hallway. And so I guess the question is, if there's no indication in the part of the transcript after the meeting that there was no pressure applied or that the plea was done knowingly, voluntarily, without coercion or any inducement of promises or anything like that, how can the allegation of pressure be conclusively refuted?
And so I think that the last question in the colloquy before the plea is tendered is, are you pleading guilty to this offense because you are in fact guilty of this offense? And Ms. Park said yes.
But how does that refute, and I'm not sure this is the exact allegation, but assume for the moment the allegation is, when the judge tells you yes, you say yes to everything. I'm telling you, you must do that or you're going to jail for the rest of your life. And if you don't do this, I'm withdrawing from the plea, I'm withdrawing from this case, and you're on your own. How does that refute allegations of pressure that was applied by attorney to client to get client to plead guilty?
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I don't think that Ms. Park's allegation of pressure goes that far. And the point that I would make with respect to what I think the record is, had the reason Ms. Parks was pleading guilty been because my attorney pressured me in the other room, that was her opportunity to say so to the court. So had it been as egregious as the situation that you just described, perhaps answering a slightly different question, are you doing it because you're in fact guilty, would not have cured that. But that's not her allegation, and certainly there's no support for the allegation. And I noticed earlier that...
Let's go back to the coercion. It was also, she had confirmed in the written agreement as well that she had a right to plead not guilty and that this was not the product of coercion or anything like that, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so the background principle is, after having agreed to that in writing and being orally advised of it and agreeing to it, she understood that it would be improper for her to be coerced.
I believe that the record supports that conclusion, yes. I'd like to go back to something that you said when questioning opposing counsel earlier about the massaging of the record by the magistrate. So I think what the court can see as we march through the record here is that there have been a lot of morphing and adding of claims at different times. So the initial 2255 set out a rehafe-based knowledge claim, and of course, taking us back in time, when the original plea was entered, that decision had not yet come down. And then by the time of the 2255, there had been that change. And the magistrate found with respect to that knowledge-based claim on the 922G that no evidentiary hearing was required because the law was such that we were not required to plead and prove things that the Supreme Court had not yet set forth. Obviously, the record did not contain that. Now, after the government filed its response, about 6 months passed, and then Ms. Parks filed an untimely reply, which was past the statute of limitations, past her opportunity to amend her 2255, and she said some more stuff. Which
are you talking about the memo?
No, sir, that came after the magistrate's R&R.
The memo in support?
Oh, I'm sorry. I think she titled it memo in support. You're right.
Memorandum brief in support of motion to vacate. That was in front of the magistrate, was it not?
Yes, after the government's response and after a time in which she would otherwise have been allowed to amend.
In the memo, though, she states, and I'm looking at page 23 of docket entry 106, counsel failed to reasonably investigate the case despite overwhelming evidence that petitioner was not aware of the gun being in the car. See the change of plea transcript. Counsel allowed her to plead guilty to a section 922G1 charge. That's the allowed part that he references. And then in subsection B of that section of her memo, she states, counsel pressured petitioner to plead guilty and the district court accepted a plea without a factual basis, and the evidence was insufficient to support a conviction. That's where the pressure comes from, right?
Yes, and so obviously that's a different way of framing her concerns about her conviction and her sentence than had been first before the court in her 2255, her first claim being they did not plead or prove that I knew I was a prohibited person. The magistrate nonetheless considered those new claims as he understood them.
And you didn't object to that framing?
I did not. And then the district court accepted the R&R. The R&R included a finding that there was no need for an evidentiary hearing, and no objection was filed by that to Ms. Parks. So that brings us to this court today on the evidence that we have, which we contend is insufficient to meet her burden.
Let me ask you this. What, under Hill, what is the burden, what is the Strickland burden under Hill?
She has to demonstrate first that she would have proceeded to trial.
Well, the first is
deficient advice.
So there's deficient advice, and then what's the second?
She has to demonstrate prejudice.
And what's prejudice under for plea as framed by the Supreme Court in Hill?
So if we confine ourselves only to Hill, it would be that the outcome of the proceeding would have been different. In other words, that she would have proceeded to trial.
Right.
But if we march forward in the Supreme Court's precedent, and we look at Lee in 2017, it counsels that we're to look at the entire proceeding and not just the guilty plea. And that's a case that was cited in opposing counsel's brief more heavily than was in the government's brief. And so there's been no showing of what would have been the ultimate outcome of this case had she been allowed to withdraw her plea.
So is it your contention that either of those showings can be made, either the entire proceeding would come out differently, or that counsel or that client would not have accepted the plea but for ineffective assistance?
I think we have to look at the precedent as a whole, and I think we have to show that the entire outcome would have been different because Lee comes after Hill versus Lockhart. And there's been no showing on that at this point. And I also think that there's a component of, under Padilla, considering whether it's rational for this court to accept that she would not have entered the plea under these circumstances. And as we've indicated earlier, there was a significant benefit to Ms. Parks under the plea that she took.
Is there even an allegation of prejudice in either the original motion or the memorandum?
I don't believe that there is. I don't believe there's allegation or a supported allegation.
Is that deficient on its own? In other words, because we're in allegation land, not evidence land, is that alone a basis in which to deny?
I think it's fatal to their claim. They don't have anything, no assertion and no supported assertion before this court of what the prejudice is to Ms. Parks as a result of the decision that she chose to make.
I've read both, and I can tell you that I'm not sure where there's a prejudice allegation, so I'm interested in knowing where that allegation is.
I actually searched for the word prejudice in opposing counsel's brief, and it's really only in the heading that Panero's performance prejudiced Parks.
Well, I'm not talking about the brief. I'm talking about Ms. Greenaway's brief is excellent, but I'm talking about the motion that was originally filed in front of the magistrate judge and the memorandum in front of the magistrate judge.
I don't believe it asserted or showed prejudice in any way. And on that basis, I believe the claim fails. If there are no other questions from the judges,
I will question.
We'd ask you to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Greenaway, you have 5 minutes.
So, Judge Luck, I want to hone in on your prejudice question that you had. So Lee versus United States tells us that in assessing prejudice, you look at the type of error that is alleged to have occurred. And so here, the type of error that we are alleging is that trial counsel erroneously advised her as to the willful blindness theory, erroneously proffered a theory that was unsupported by the factual evidence at that time in accordance with Rivera. So when we look at that, we assess prejudice on whether or not the guilty plea would have been permitted or accepted. And to that point,
doesn't there have to be an allegation of that at the very least? In other words, doesn't client have to say, I would not have accepted the plea would not have been accepted, or the outcome of the entire case would have come out the other way? There has to be some allegation of that, doesn't there?
So you're on 2 points. And I'm going to find this for the court, and if your court would allow it, I'm happy to.
No, it's okay. Tell me what it is, and I will go look. I promise.
So I believe that in Ms. Park's memo, she cites the Strickland standard, and then she discusses how the performance was deficient, and that she would not have accepted the plea. So that's discussed in that section.
All right.
And I'm happy to point the court to in a supplemental letter.
If you want to do that, that's fine. I'm going to go look myself. I just wanted to know if it was your understanding that allegation was made.
Sure. And separately, because she was pro se at that time, her pleading should be construed liberally as well. And so to the extent that she didn't exactly identify or say the word prejudice, that should not be held against her when she adequately laid out her problems to the point that led Judge Jordan here to issue a COA on that particular issue. So I think that should not be held against her. And so to the prejudice point, when we're assessing prejudice, we look at whether or not the outcome would have been different. And Lee tells us that in the context of a guilty plea, we don't look at whether or not her results would have been better at trial. We look at whether or not the guilty plea would have been accepted and permitted to proceed forward. Here we know for a fact that it would not have occurred. And we don't have to look any further than the district court's own words on the matter. And the district court made very clear, and I quote from the record, and that's page 10 of the transcript. And Ms. Parks, I understand what you're saying, but I can't let you plead guilty to something you didn't do. If you didn't know the gun was in the car, then you're not guilty of this crime, and I cannot let you plead guilty. Even I understand, and this part is important, Your Honors, because even though Ms. Parks had her own subjective statements about her then desire to go to trial, those are not what's legally relevant in terms of assessing prejudice under Lee versus United States and under this court's precedent. What's important is that she was disclaiming knowledge of the gun, and because it went to a factual element of the underlying crime, the court could not accept the plea. So the court goes on to say, even I understand the logic behind it, but I have to make a finding of fact. And if you did not know that gun was in the car, you were not in constructive possession of it, and I cannot accept this plea. So this court doesn't have to engage in any speculation about whether or not trial counsel's error led to prejudice here, because had he withdrawn the plea at that point, the plea would not have been accepted. And I'm happy to answer any more questions.
If we can go to the pressure issue, which frankly, just speaking only for myself, is the one that I'm having the most trouble with.
Sure.
Why does the record not conclusively demonstrate that there was no pressure? So not only there did she say, I haven't been coerced to do this, not only does she, and I understand your point on prejudice, but she subjectively wants to do this plea. Not only the quote that Judge Carnes read, but she later says, I can't do it with all these charges that time. Chief Judge Pryor read from the plea agreement. There's another section of the plea agreement which specifically says, I was not coerced into entering into this plea agreement. Given all of that, how can we say that there was pressure applied here?
Well, after the recess, Your Honor, she contend, she said no less than six times, and we have this citation in our reply brief. She said no less than six times that she still did not know that that gun was in the car. And so,
yeah, but that's not that is. I don't think I did it. Not that I don't want to plead guilty.
Right. But this goes to the point, because willful blindness can't even be proffered when importantly Rivera says that you can't even rely on willful blindness if the only evidence is actual knowledge or no knowledge.
I understand in terms of whether the court should have accepted the plea, whether the standard have been met here, but we're talking about whether counsel was ineffective by applying pressure. How does any of that go to whether pressure was applied when the client seems to indicate that, no, I really want to do this. I was not coerced and I was not, my plea is voluntary.
Well, you know, Your Honor, I think candidly we don't know. And I think that's the point and the problem with the fact that we don't have any evidence on this record. And I want to briefly respond to the government's point about the evidentiary hearing in the brief, because they got that law wrong. This court is not hamstringed by the COA. And to that point, I would like to, I'm out of time. May I briefly finish?
Briefly finish.
Okay.
Briefly.
Sure. So Judge Carnes' opinion, you authored United States versus Stone, that made clear that the court is not hamstringed by the COA. You can construe the COA to include an evidentiary hearing.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. Greenway. I note you were court appointed, and thank you for accepting the appointment, and you discharged that responsibility very ably this morning. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We will move to our last.